Hello and welcome to another episode of Two Guys and a Chainsaw. I'm Todd.
And I'm Craig.
Well, this week I chose the movie, and I wanted to go back to the 80s to a film that I have been wanting to do forever, especially since I fell in love with Brian Usna. Brian Usna didn't direct this movie, but he produced it, and then Stuart Gordon, who is a close associate of his, I think the both of them actually wrote the story for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. We did The Reanimator that Stuart Gordon directed and really, really enjoyed it. So I was excited to come to this film, which is called From Beyond. It is a 86. The year after Reanimator, Stuart Gordon just basically, because he was an old theater guy, he started, I believe it's called the Organic Theater in Chicago, which I'm not sure if it's still going. About 10 years ago, it was still going. He started it back in the late 60s, but very respected theater troupe and was very used to just working with the same actors over and over again. So he felt like he could get better results on his next feature if he just used the same people. And so we've got Barbara Crampton in here, Jeffrey Combs in here, both starring in this movie again. And I wanted to see them again. So I just thought, yeah, let's just do this. It's funny because I think a lot of people who are into horror know of this movie, but I don't hear people talk about it so much. Yeah, I'd never seen it before. I think I saw the cover art on the video store shelves, but was never particularly compelled to pick it up. And God, I wish I had, because Teenage Todd would have frickin' loved this movie for so many reasons. But also, you know, 46-year-old Todd really digs it too. I'm just going to come right out and say I loved it. I'd never seen it before. So glad I saw it. I'll probably watch it again. How about you, Craig? You seen this before?
No, I haven't. And much like you, like I kind of can't believe that I haven't seen it, because the image from the box cover, I know that so well, and I can't believe that I never picked it up. Now, to be fair, I wasn't really like a big Brian Usna or Stuart Gordon fan really before we did this. I think I had seen one or two when I was like in graduate school or doing my internship or whatever, but you and I now have watched a bunch of these guys' movies, and they're wacky, and I like that they're wacky.
It's right.
They're weird, and these in particular are based on H.P. Lovecraft stories, and you and I have talked about this before. Like, I really like H.P. Lovecraft in theory. Right. Actually reading him, it's very dense.
Kind of stodgy.
Yeah, and this movie and Stuart Gordon's other H.P. Lovecraft adaptations, I feel like make Lovecraft really accessible to me and to other people like me. Did you read this story, From Beyond?
No, I was kind of curious about it because it's only like 7 pages long. Did you?
I did. I read it last night.
Oh.
Just because I was curious, because I really liked the movie.
Uh-huh.
And I say I really liked the movie. That doesn't mean it's a good movie. Like, it's goofy, but I was entertained, and it's short. It's only an hour and 25 minutes long. What I was really interested to find was that the movie is reasonably faithful to the story.
Really?
Yeah, and Lovecraft is so heady, and he's typically very vague in his, like, he talks about these ancient gods and these ancient beasts and things, but he's typically pretty vague in his descriptions of them. He'll just say, like, it was the most awful thing you can imagine, like, just gazing upon it will kill you. Like, in fact, that happens in this story. I say it's relatively faithful, but it's also very different. The short story is very much like Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher, where there are really only two characters. There's the crazy guy and the guy that's narrating and visiting him. That's very much what this is like.
Right.
And it's interesting because Crawford Tillinghast, who is played by Jeffrey Combs in this movie, in the story, that name is used, but it's really used for the character of Edward, the one that gets like super caught up in everything and gets corrupted by it.
Mm-hmm.
in the story, this unnamed, as far as I remember, narrator visits his old friend, Crawford Tillinghast, and then it's just a story of this guy. And I visited my friend, and here is this crazy story that he told me. And then he tells the whole story. Yeah, he tells the whole story of how he invented this machine. But everything is very similar. Like, there are no tuning forks, but there is, like, a big electrical machine that can tune into these other places. And when you're in these other places, you can see in a different way. Like, and it's more specific. Like, it's supposed to not just bring the little penis out of your head. But, like, it talks about how, like, we only have access to 5 senses, but there are astounding senses beyond that.
Right. Which is true.
Maybe. I don't know. Whatever. But it's a... And at the end, it turns out that the scientist guy lured this guy here because he has to appease the beast.
Oh.
And so, like, to appease the beast, he has to feed him other people so that it doesn't eat him. That's the only difference. But all of the stuff about
the gland coming out, yeah.
Whatever gland that is, it's all in there.
Really?
I was really surprised by how, I mean, it's a fairly faithful, the movie certainly takes liberties, but the core of the story is really pretty faithful.
Is the sexiness and all that in there too? Probably not, right?
No.
It was a different time.
It's like, I felt like it was kind of suggested by saying there are all sorts of senses and sensations that we don't have access to.
Oh.
And I actually, like, watching the movie, I thought that was kind of silly and, like, salacious. Like, you get some sexy times in the movie. But it actually, it makes sense. I mean,
if you're
talking about heightening our ability to experience sensation, whatever that means, I'm certainly going to be interested in.
Well,
I mean, like sure, like, I'd love to smell better, but let's talk about my wiener. What can we do in that department?
It is what drives technology, you know, the development of the internet and everything. We all know that. You know, I was getting major Hellraiser vibes from this because it's very similar thematically,
yeah.
Right? A guy who is just kind of seeking for the ultimate pleasures. And so he goes into this other dimension to
beyond.
Try to find it where he can get that. And then, of course, it's a little too much and it sort of starts to overtake him and it invites that other world into our world. It's so Hellraiser that I just kind of feel like Clive Barker was tapping into something here that, but when did Hellraiser come out?
I don't know. I was looking at dates. That's why
Now because I'm super curious. It is so close that it's almost, this is like the chaster version of Hellraiser, I think, in some ways.
But it's not chaste either.
No.
I like that about it. And you had already kind of alluded to it, Hellraiser 1987.
Oh, the year after?
Yeah, but that's
but
so
that's
close.
It's too much overlap. It's not going to... They might have been aware of each other while they were in production, but this was also...
Yeah.
Hellraiser was a production that Clive Barker was, you know, fretting over for quite a while and,
yeah.
you know, working at.
Oh,
so.
Well, and it was based on a book, you know?
Yeah, he'd already written, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Speaking of overlap, though, I was super amused to find that Stuart Gordon filmed Dolls at the exact, like, he was filming this at the same time. He was filming them both at the same time.
Crazy, right?
We've done that movie, and I love that movie. And right after we're done here, we're going to record a mini-sode about, like, the first horror movies that we've ever seen. And I know that wasn't one of the first ones I've ever seen, but it was an early one.
It's the one you're going to talk about.
I don't know if I'll talk about it at length, but that was one of the early ones. And that's not a great movie, but I like it a lot.
We loved Dolls. We did an episode on Dolls, and we just thought there was something very charming about it. And I think maybe that was the episode where I was like, this was not really in my consciousness when I was into horror growing up and when I was watching all these movies and not really knowing who produced what and whatnot. But now that we've been doing this podcast, this whole thread of pictures that have come from Empire Pictures and Full Moon Productions, they're basically the same thing, you know, produced by Charles Band. It's its own niche within the horror genre. And it was something that I kind of overlooked when I was, I think when I was a teenager, I was like, oh, these are the low budget, this is sort of the low budget crap. This is the weird shit that when I did touch upon, I'm like, oh, that's bizarre. Now, I just appreciate it so much, like the inventiveness, the sheer volume of productions that they've done. And it just seems to be that these folks that have come out of the Charles Band camp and have been making these movies under his production house, they have these wackadoodle movies that we need. You know, you can only watch so much of the same shit over and over and over again. You need something fresh and weird and wacky. And they have been delivering for decades.
Yeah.
And this is right in that realm. And not only that, but you wouldn't even believe that this movie's low budget. The effects in this film are insane.
Yeah.
They're all practical. They're quite good. It's gross and it's weird. It's this body horror. It's sort of like a low-rent David Cronenberg.
Yeah.
And yeah, of course, it's low budget. But he even said, I think it was Charles Band or maybe it was Stuart Gordon himself, said that if they had made this movie in the United States, it would have cost $15 million. But they went to Empire Pictures headquarters at the time, which was in an old Dino De Laurentiis studio, which was literally, I think, a castle in frickin' Italy that they had for a little while. And they were doing these programs there for much cheaper. And so this ended up costing only like $2.5 million. And so they saved money that way. But boy, did they put a lot of money up on screen, I think. The special effects are just wild. Five different yeah. special effects houses working on this. And for that alone, I was just giddy.
Yeah.
To be honest, like watching this, I almost didn't care about the story because everything that was flashing before my eyes was so damn crazy. I couldn't stop watching and I loved it.
Yeah. And that's what I've come to expect from Brian Yuzna movies, like lots of practical effects and they're fun. I loved them too. And there are a lot, like there are like monster effects in this and it's all tangible, you know, like that's what I love about practical effects. Like, I feel like that it's something that I could touch.
Right.
Even if it may not look as slick as CGI, but it looks like something that I could touch and it would be slimy and wet and organic. And I don't know. I'm not going to speak ill of CGI. CGI is great. Thank God we have it. It led to a lot of great things, but I still love those practical effects. But even in dumb Yuzna movies that we've seen, and I say dumb, I still loved it. Silent Night, Deadly Night 3 or 4,
four.
Five,
The Toymaker. Yeah. Oh, he did 4. Yeah.
Do you remember like Clint Howard and those like
worm
leeches things?
That was 4. The Initiation, yeah.
I love that.
It was Screaming Mad George, I think, who did the effects for The Initiation, which was that weird witch coven thing with him and the worms and stuff. But then even 5, which I don't think he directed that, and that had like Mickey Rooney in it.
Oh, yeah, we did it too.
Yeah, it was like The Toy Maker, and it had the same guy, Screaming Mad George, who did the effects on that. This had 5 special effects team, and none of them were Screaming Mad George. I was kind of surprised because we did Society, which was the Yuzna movie that we will never forget.
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, it's so good. And it's similar type stuff, really. All this kind of weird body morphing, gross, slimy stuff.
Yeah.
Did you read about how difficult it was for them to get like an R rating for this film?
Yeah, a little bit. But also, I feel like I read that they didn't have to cut that much. It surprises me that they didn't mess with the MPAA for Reanimator, and they just released it unrated.
Yeah.
I guess they hoped that they would be able to reach a wider audience with a rating.
They were hoping for more money this time around. They felt maybe they got burned a little bit on Reanimator, you know? I think they were thinking they needed a rating. And so they went a lot of back and forth, and Stuart Gordon said the frustrating thing was that the MPAA just, they were like, all of it as a whole, we just can't accept. They didn't give any pointed directions like, well, cut this scene or cut that scene. And they really didn't want to cut any scenes. So they just started trimming little bits and pieces here and there from different scenes. And finally, at one point, they came back and said, look, cut this single frame and we'll give you an R. And so thankfully, the majority of what they wanted, especially scene-wise, all remained intact. And it's so quaint, like today all this would pass like with no problem.
My gosh.
Like, there's been so much worse. It's funny because I guess there was a quote from Stuart Gordon who talked about how a member of the MPAA on the board at the time said something like, well, your last movie was super bloody. And he's like, so they intentionally went more slimy than bloody. And he said, they said, honestly, this is worse.
It's more gross.
It's grosser.
Yeah. I read that too. And I kind of agree. When you saw that kind of red tinted, it's not red slime. It's like slime with like red pigmentation in it. Like floating out from under a door. That was gross. There were a lot of gross things. I also read that they ran out of budget to do everything that they wanted to do in the finale. And I feel like you can kind of tell because the antagonist gets more monstrous throughout the course of the movie. And in the end, obviously, like it's supposed to be its final form. But they had to do a lot. Like, most of it is an extreme face
close-ups. Yeah.
Which is fine. I liked that, too. I thought the actor was good and menacing. And we understand. We get glimpses of what it looks like. We don't need to see it in full all the time.
No.
That's fine. I didn't have a problem with it. In fact, if I hadn't read that they ran out of money, I don't think it would have crossed my mind. I think I would have said, actually, that's a good choice. Get in on his face.
I thought that was actually good at the end of the day because it was more expressive. The makeup and everything was so good and so seamless even in those close-up shots that it allowed the actor to be expressive, and he was. I was really impressed. And I think even Stuart Gordon said at the end of the day, they ended up with a better product because of it, because he said his original cut might have lingered a little too long on the SFX to make it so that the audience had a little more time to kind of see the seams. But I think, honestly, the sliminess and maybe why it's so much more gross, and in particularly when you kind of look at this movie and how it thematically ends up, it's more sexual.
This movie is so horny.
This movie is
a horny movie.
It really is. And so slime more than blood and these kind of fluids. Oh, God. I loved it for that, man. By the way. God, Barbara Crampton is...
I gotta tell you, there is a moment in this movie where it may have been getting a little rumbly in my downstairs.
You? Wow. I mean, I certainly was. No question here.
I mean, I don't know how we're going to approach this. Like, are we going to go back and talk about the plot? I don't know. But there was that moment. There was that moment near the end where Barbara Crampton was getting sexy, and I was like...
Yeah, there was a moment near the end where I was like, yeah, definitely movies that never went by the MPAA, you know, go down this road on a way more frequent basis. Oh, my God.
That brings up a lot of things. So Stuart Gordon had already made Reanimator, and he had this idea. You know all this. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the listeners. Stuart Gordon had this idea that he wanted to do a bunch of H.P. Lovecraft adaptations using the same actors, much as who was the filmmaker? I want to say the Vincent Price Edgar Allan Poe movies.
Yeah, Roger Corman's
Edgar Allan Poe movies that used Vincent Price and a lot of the same actors all the time. And he did for a little while. He made two or three movies with these folks, and he fought to get Barbara Crampton in this movie because she plays like a renowned psychologist. she's like 12. No, she's not. She's a fully grown woman, but she looks very young, and the producers were concerned that people wouldn't believe her as a psychologist. Who cares? I can't believe that horror producers in the 80s were concerned that we weren't going to believe that Barbara Crampton was old enough to be a renowned psychologist. Who cares?
Yeah.
So they put her in like black framed glasses and pulled her hair back to make her look more professional, I guess.
Magically.
But who cares? But at the same time, she is so beautiful in this movie.
Oh, God.
This podcast has made me a huge fan of Barbara Crampton. Like, I love her. I love everything she's in. I get excited when she's in something new. She still looks fantastic. I think that she is an amazing horror actress. Like, keep casting her.
Full disclosure, when we watched The Reanimator, which was one of her first films, of course, everything about how great she looks and how great her body is and how willing she is to do nudity and all that stuff aside, when I saw The Reanimator, I thought, oh, you know, this is clearly one of her first films. Maybe her acting, like, isn't 100% the best. I don't remember what my assessment was exactly when we did The Reanimator, but that was just my impression, because it's been a while. This movie, oh my God, I was like, this woman is a great actress. She's really bringing it to a role that she didn't need to bring it to, you know?
That's true. Like,
this role doesn't require the degree of actual convincing emotion that she brings to it. And she's got it, the pressure on, because there's a lot of close-up. I think Stuart Gordon likes close-up. You know, he gets right in the faces of his actors in these scenes, which is dangerous to do when you're doing a low-budget production with B-list actors. And there were moments in here where I was like, oh, my God, like, she's really good. Like, the expression she's giving or the way she read that line, it was fantastic.
I loved her. Jeffrey Combs, on the other hand, who I would count them as co-leads. They both have about the same amount of screen time. Jeffrey Combs is one of those actors who he kind of like...
does that one thing.
Yeah, but that's fine.
Yeah.
He's a character actor, and he's kind of like, he's super, super expressive in his face. And I think that that's probably one of the reasons for so many close-ups, is because Jeffrey Combs is a face actor.
Like, he is
a face actor, but he's fun to watch.
He is.
And I think that he's perfect for these types of movies, because they're exaggerated. They're hyperbolic. They're not set in a realm of reality.
Right.
Jeffrey Combs would have been great in like silent movies, like, that's right. The kind of style he brings, and I dig it.
I know.
I just like this movie overall, and it's crazy, and I don't mind that we've been talking for almost half an hour and haven't gotten to the plot.
It's really fine. Don't. It's simple. The plot's simple.
The plot is so simple, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even, like, it's established in such a simple way. It's not like we get a bunch of exposition. We open on Jeffrey Combs, and he's got this room full of computers and this big machine in the middle that entails like a bunch of tuning forks and stuff. And then he turns it on and the lights get all crazy and he sees ghost eels and one of them attacks him. So basically the story is he and his mentor have invented this thing that can send out vibrations to stimulate your, what is it?
Pineal gland.
And I looked this stuff up, and like, it's real. Like, even H.P. Lovecraft knew about this gland,
right?
That I've never heard of. And it can, like, it can stimulate that gland, and it can allow you to, some other philosopher, Descartes or somebody else, described it as your third eye. Like, it's, and you can see different things. And so they've invented this thing, and it works. But then they also see, like, it opens up
their sight into the other dimension that's kind of always around us, right?
Yeah, it's always around us. And the story explains that really well. The story, hold on, I wrote down how it explained it. It said that you see all of this other stuff that's around us all the time. But the way that the story explained it was like, you see it, but it's all like superimposed on reality. So
right.
you still see everything that's real, but all this other stuff that you don't usually see is like superimposed on that. But the other thing, again, true to the story, is if you move, they can see you too. And while the machine is on, if they can see you, they can interact with you, which means they can attack you. And that's what kicks off the plot, is that he runs and gets his boss, partner.
Yeah.
Weird pervert.
His mentor. This guy played by Ted Sorrell, who I could have sworn I'd seen in more stuff, but
I
looked him up and I'm like, no, he's just got a face that must look like another actor that I can't name.
Same.
And you know immediately this guy's a dick, you know? He almost comes across as Hugh Hefner, you know? He's in his lounge, his silk lounge, where he comes in and he's mean and he jumps in the middle of this field, whereas Jeffrey Combs' character, whose name is Crawford, is terrified.
Edward, Shut it off.
Never. Can't you feel it? Robert, in the mind. The mind.
It's out of control. You've got to turn it off.
No. No. No, I want to see more. More than any man has ever seen.
Edward. It's running itself!
Something's coming.
And it starts to overtake him. Jeffrey Combs gets bit by one of these giant flying eels, and I think he has that wound on his face the entire, entire movie. Because the whole movie only takes place over the course of like a few days, right?
Yeah.
So, it bites him. Edward's called in. And then there's this cat lady neighbor or dog lady neighbor who calls the police, says, weird stuff's happening across the street like it always is. And then her dog runs off. So then she has to go and chase it into the house. So she kind of gets up in there. I thought she was going to die or her dog was going to die.
That was funny. There are funny parts of this movie. It's funny that the dog's name was Bunny, and that's the actual name of the actress who played that woman.
I noticed that.
I wondered if that was like an in-joke. I don't know. And she was funny. And the movie, Stuart Gordon's movies definitely have a sense of humor. They're not outright comedies, but they're just so exaggerated or over the top.
A little campy.
Yeah, oh, very campy, I would say, but I don't mind that. In fact, I like it. So something goes wrong. I mean, that guy, Edward or whatever, turns out, you find out that he's like a freak. Like, he likes like whip, like chain up women and whip them and stuff.
Got a sex dungeon. Yeah.
He is a sex dungeon. And in that moment when the main guy, Crawford, knocks on his door, like, the machine worked. Well, there was a cut scene. I don't remember if they filmed it or not, but on the other side of that door, Edward was supposed to be nailing a woman's tongue to a board. Like, what?
I read that too. I didn't understand that. I didn't see how, even in my mind's eye, I could not picture how this scene would.
Well, but you, I feel like you said that this movie is much like Hellraiser, and that would have made it even more, that would have made it feel like a Hellraiser movie.
That's true.
Like they're exploring pleasure and pain.
Pain.
And yeah, I am so not into that. Like I am.
Same here.
Pain, no thank you, pass.
I can't relate, but I respect it. You
sure,
know,
sure.
That's your like, thing. Yeah, do it.
And I understand, you know, exploring boundaries and stuff like that. Not my thing, but no shame, whatever. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The movie basically becomes Jeffrey Combs, like, supposedly destroys the machine, but he doesn't really.
They can't.
He really just knocks one of the tuning forks off, but then he gets put in an institution, and we meet Barbara Crampton, who is Dr. Catherine McMichael. Dr. Catherine McMichaels.
Right.
And she gets introduced to Jeffrey Combs, and she's fascinated by his story.
I was assisting Dr. Pretorius with his experiments, yes. Mm-hmm.
What was the purpose of the experiments?
To stimulate the pineal gland with resonant vibrations.
The pineal gland? Why?
Dr. Pretorius believed the pineal was a dormant sensory organ, a sixth sense.
Yes. Well, that's not a new theory. The philosopher Descartes believed it was the third eye.
It's not a theory. It's a fact.
Then your experiments worked. They proved the theory.
And immediately, she wants to recreate the experiments. And there's another doctor in the institution that, like, wants to block it, but can't. And so they release Jeffrey Combs into Dr. Catherine McMichael's custody so that she can take him immediately back to the house and they can immediately put the machine back together because all he did was knock off a tuning fork. So he just puts it back and then they immediately turn it on. And there's also another guy, Bubba. Right? Is that his name?
Yeah. Good old Bubba by Ken Forey, you know, Mr. Dawn of the Dead. He's been in so many of these horror movies.
Oh. I loved him in this movie. One of the reasons...
He was great in this movie.
Yeah, well, great in this movie because sometimes I felt his line readings were like, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is the stupidest shit I've ever said.
Yes, he was playing that guy. I mean, you know, it's a little cringy today, but
I'm the only one with any sense. And he is.
But I'm still not going to use my authority as a policeman to stop any of it.
No. No, but he is the only one with any sense. But it's hilarious. It's so funny because then they start messing with the machine, but they explain what the machine does and how it opens you up to different senses and But they turn it on and Barbara Crampton is immediately.
Yeah, the minute they turn the machine on, she's turned on. It pretty much, it's obvious from that. Looks over at Jeffrey Combs and she, and they have these moments. Yeah.
She is a wet. Like, she is like, there's a mess on the floor. She's so into it.
Yeah.
The story is that Edward, the pervert, like a monster bit off his head. A monster came from beyond and bit off his head. And we've seen that. And that's what Jeffrey Combs kept saying. And that's why they said he was crazy. They're like, he's like, it ate him. It ate him. Okay, fine. All right. Now they turn the machine back on. They get all tingly on their insides. And then then Edward shows back up. And when he first shows up, he's normal, but he's naked and he's covered in goo. But other than that, it's just him.
Until Jeffrey touches him, and then it's like his flesh is like silly putty. He can just kind of press his flesh around. And you realize it's not actually the doctor. It's this creature that is sort of assumed the doctor's form, clearly right. Part of his personality or something like that. His soul or whatever has sort of transcended to this realm and merged with this creature, I guess, or vice versa. It's not very clear.
Well, whatever. I think that this creature from beyond, you know, it ate this guy's head. I think it's just assuming his base to mess with these folks. And that's what it does. It keeps messing with them. I have a page and a half of notes. I have no idea why I do this. I don't even look at them. But it keeps messing with them. But the thing is, like, first of all, Jeffrey Combs tells her from the beginning, no, we can't do it.
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as they get there, he fixes it and they do it immediately. Like,
yeah.
And then there are bad consequences and they turn it off and they're like, no, we can't do it again. And then they do it
and
again.
And they do it again. Yeah. I mean, Jeffrey Combs, his character... it's kind of written, the writing's a little unconvincing here. This guy would be fighting tooth and nail. He'd be climbing the walls. He'd be like, put me back in the institution. I'm not going to do this shit again.
Right, or just get me out of here.
Yeah, but it's all this weird bullshit where the police officer turns him over to her custody. So now she's like, you're either going to be in an institution or here. Like, none of this shit actually happens in real life. You can't just, like, pass people back and forth into other people's care, like, on a whim. That being said, it gives Jeffrey Combs an excuse to look distressed and upset through the entire thing. And that's the best you can do with this writing, right? If it's going to be so ridiculous that he's being forced to do this thing, then, of course, he's going to just look wild-eyed and upset about it the entire time he's fixing the machine up against his will and putting it together. Also, Catherine, her character, is kind of the same. Like, you can't imagine that this woman who goes through these experiences over and over and over again is going to just be more energized.
No, it's so stupid. The first time it goes terribly wrong and they're all traumatized by it, but she then cooks herself a full breakfast and is like exhilarated, and the cop is like,
well, we learned what we came for. He ain't crazy, and that it ate Pretorius's head. They're gonna think we're crazy, but that's their problem.
Well, we just have to try the experiment again.
Did you say we?
Catherine, you can't.
You don't mean go back up there now, do you?
You always run an experiment twice to check the results.
Wait. Now, I saw it get to him, Catherine. Just exactly what you're feeling, and it ruined him.
Pretorius. Yes. I'd like to know more about him. That resonator is a work of genius.
And she's like, well, I know that that didn't go right, but next time,
right.
I just need to make sure that I stand by the switch. Yeah, I just need to make sure that I'm in control so I can turn off the machine when necessary.
Like, yeah.
I mean, this is also not uncommon. Like, this mad scientist thing, like flirting with danger,
right.
This isn't uncommon. It's just like, this is a 22-year-old woman. I just don't buy it. I don't care. I don't care.
I don't care either, but we're talking about it. We're critically analyzing it. It's funny because I don't buy it. I would potentially buy it if I just thought maybe in a way she's just as crazy as Pretorius was. Like deep down inside her psyche, she's got this like super horny bit that particularly was awakened by the machine. And she herself is kind of seeking that pleasure, which is sort of where Hellraiser tends to go.
Well, this goes there too.
It does, but there's that scene where she gives an alternate excuse. You know, it's like they try to bring it to reality. This is when she's trying to convince Jeffrey Combs' character to do it again. She's like, my father, you know, my father was holed up in a mental institution and he was tortured and he died. And my whole life's work is to make sure this never happens to anyone else again. And so I'm just thinking that this research could be the thing, you know, it proves everything we thought about this gland and yada, 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 yada. So we've got to do it again. I was like, oh, come on.
That was like, such bullshit. In my notes, I have it as dumbass sob story about dad.
Yeah.
Who cares? Who cares?
But it just gives us the next great scene because they go up again. She turns it on. She's by the thing. Pretorius appears again. This time he's even more monstrous than before. He looks like he's half transformed the thing from Thing. The Thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then he pulls her. He's got this tentacle type thing that just kind of slashes out and pulls her towards him before she can do anything. Combs runs out of the room. He doesn't give a shit. He just leaves, leaving her. This guy's got her behind the throat. And then his hand is there. And all of a sudden, he extends his fingers, rips off her shirt. Oh, my God, this got so sexual.
What was he doing?
What was he doing with those fingers when they dropped out of the frame? It was pretty insane. So this gets insane and she is distressed as fuck. And I'm so impressed with Barbara Crampton and how she played this. Jeffrey Combs runs to the basement. I think the guy gets there. Isn't this where the giant worm is in the basement?
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, they turn the machine off and on two or three times. The Edward monster gets progressively and progressively more and more grotesque.
Yeah.
It always has his face on like some kind of appendage or stuff. But there's also snake-like things will like burst out of his face or out of his body or whatever. And this part that you're talking about, Bubba has said, we're done. We're not doing this anymore. Let's take a nap and then we're leaving. And so they all like go to bed. But she gets up and she turns it on by herself. And of course, the big monster comes out. And then Jeffrey Combs comes and like tries to rescue her. And I don't remember exactly what happens. But then you're right. He just runs away. He runs downstairs. And there is a big like snake monster. I don't know how to describe it. It looks like a lamprey. You know,
yeah, like, it's kind of like a graboid in a way, kind of a simpler. Yeah,
yeah, just a big circular open maw lined with teeth.
Impressive.
It is impressive, except that in some parts it looked like it was made out of hefty bags, which is fine. I mean, it was still a tangible thing that they were dealing with. And the other thing from this scene that I thought was so funny was that eventually, like, Bubba comes out and helps. But they've been in bed, so he's just in these tiny briefs for this whole scene.
He does the whole scene like that. That was great.
And I enjoyed it.
There's a little something for everybody in this movie,
there
what we're
is.
Trying to say.
Oh, a little something for everybody. And then so I feel like at this point they beat those monsters and then they're still not leaving, but they're trying to leave.
Well, she's so upset by the end of this. I felt like, oh, this is her turning point. Like, this is the moment where I don't know what's going to happen, but she's going to be convinced she doesn't need to do this anymore. Like, but no, she once she's by herself in the sex dungeon and gets a look at all that equipment, suddenly she gets real curious about it. And so the idea is that, you know, I think with every time this sort of thing happens and they're in the field and their gland gets excited or whatnot, it has a change and effect on them. And that's what's happening to
her.
God, and we've completely forgotten about Jeffrey Combs. Jeffrey Combs at one point got eaten halfway by the snake monster, which dissolved all of his hair and left him in kind of a catatonic state. But also, something is like pulsing and happening in his forehead, and eventually something pops out of it. Like, we are to believe that the pituitary gland has been so stimulated that it is now grown to the point that it is protruding from their heads. And I read that on set they couldn't decide what it looked more like an asparagus spear, which I think that's what I think it looks like, or a dog stick. Which I can see also in the thing that I read, it said, you know, neither one of those descriptions made Barbara Crampton feel very good about it when she had to put it in her mouth. And I read that trivia piece as I was watching the movie, and it hadn't happened yet. And I was like, if Barbara Crampton fillets that pituitary gland, I am going to fucking die. And I thought that was where it was going.
Oh, it seemed like it.
She gets super turned on in the sex dungeon.
Yeah.
And she, like, you know, touches all of the like bondage shit, and then she gets in the closet and she's like rubbing leather on her face and fondling her nipples, which I thought was hilarious. Then she puts on a full bondage outfit. Now we're talking G-string, tiny, you know, just a tiny little bit covering her lady parts, corset, and she looks great.
Like, fantastic.
This is what I'm talking about. Like, this is the part where I was like, hubba. Like, what? Like, and Alan is sitting behind me doing a puzzle, and I'm like, ooh, I'm getting a little stirring what's happening. And because then she goes over to comatose Jeffrey Combs.
Oh.
No, he's asleep. And she starts like sensually like touching him down his torso. And then she reaches down under the blanket, under his waist. There's like,
is doing something down there. And then she pulls her hand out and smells it. Holy shit.
I don't live. Oh my. And then she straddles him, and it only ends because Bubba comes in. He's like, what are you doing? And he like,
she's like, well, you told me to get dressed.
And she makes some very suggestive comments to him, too. Like,
gets up close to him.
She's ready to throw down with him, too.
It almost seems like he's kind of up for it.
He's tempted.
A bit, yeah.
I get it. Woo.
But he's like, you're asking for it. But that's the point where the machine magically comes to life. And this is the part where, you know, it's like, it's just a freaking machine. Like, just call the power company, have them cut the line, like chop the lines together. They have these kind of lame ways of bringing the machine back to life. In this case, you know, I can kind of get behind the idea that maybe these beings that always exist around us, so we just can't see them, maybe through the power of that machine being turned on enough times, have the ability to move things around. So the machine kind of plugs itself back in, and then we get another shot in the basement of that circuit breaker kind of powering back on and stuff. But then, you know, every attempt to like chop the wires, or whenever wires are separated, it's like, no, it doesn't matter. Like, just electricity can just jump from one to the other. And
well, and the cords can plug themselves back in.
Yeah. That's when they run back upstairs. So the thing comes back on. Pretorius materializes again, but not until they've all been sort of covered in bugs and locusts or something like that.
That was such a weird scene. They're all like, Crawford, Jeffrey Combs, and the girl are up there with the machine, and bugs start attacking them. And then there's some weird thing where Bubba, like, if he shines a light on them, the bugs go away. But
yeah,
then
they're attracted by the light.
But then he drops his flashlight, and then for some reason, the bugs then all attack him.
Because the light's on him.
I guess.
I don't know why he couldn't step to the side, but go on.
The bugs were attacking the other two for a long time, And then he falls on the ground and the bugs all start attacking him and they eat away all of his flesh. The other two are virtually unharmed. Like,
yeah,
that was weird. Whatever. Who cares? I like his eaten away body looked great.
Yeah.
The effects in this movie are so good and so fun.
I don't remember how they kind of stop it. Oh, she blasts a machine with an extinguisher.
Oh, what?
I don't know what that means. Does it freeze it or something? I didn't know extinguishers froze things.
I guess it renders it. Yeah.
But then it cuts to the hospital. So like now, presumably someone's called the police. They've all gone to the hospital. Jeffrey Combs is in really bad shape. He's sitting there. He's got that thing poking out of his forehead. And the doctors are like trying to probe it, but they can't. And it's also weird. Like you wouldn't imagine this would just be just another thing for them in the hospital. You'd think all stops are called and like this would be a major ordeal. Like what the fuck is going on with this guy's forehead? But that's how it is. Then Dr. Block is back. And she's going to do electroshock therapy because now custody has been granted to her over Barbara Campton's character. And so now she decides she's going to do electroshock therapy on her for just because she's sadistic, I guess. But Jeffrey Combs wakes up. And this is the part of the movie where I thought it started to really drag because Jeffrey Combs wakes up. And really what we get for the next 20 minutes is him wandering around the hospital with these urges to like eat the brains and the specimen jars in the pathology lab. And then Dr. Block pops in and he jumps on her, bites her eye out.
I think that he's supposed to be like eating their brains through their eye socket.
Yeah,
because you see one of the things that we haven't mentioned and that is in the story is that this gland is like a third eye and it allows them to see things differently. Though it's kind of basic, you do see that in the movie. Like you get weird POV that's, I don't know what that effect is.
It's like a negative or like, it's like predator vision, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's colorful negative.
That's what I was thinking too. For whatever reason, it sees and is attracted to their brains. So I think it's supposed to be he's eating their brains through their eye socket, but it looks like he's taking an apple bite out of their eyeballs. And he does that with her, and he does it with a couple of paramedics. And then he and Barbara Crampton both escape. She barely escapes her shock treatment, and they just go back to the house so that interlude at the hospital.
Pointless.
But if we didn't have it, then this would only be an hour long and it wouldn't be feature film length. So I get it. But they get back to the house.
Somewhere in there, Barbara Crampton managed to put together some dynamite with a timer. I didn't know that she had this special skill.
I missed that entirely. It wasn't until somebody, is it Jeffrey Combs, is like hanging on to her in the house, and she's like, we have to get out of here. I set a bomb. And I was like, you set a bomb?
Oh, you must have been looking away. No, there was a whole... The first thing she did when she walked in the house was go upstairs to the machine and caress it a bunch, and then set down her bag, and then she pulls out, you know, this comically large... It's a bunch of dynamite strapped together with a timer on it and straps it to it, and it's got a countdown for 4 minutes. And I thought, okay, well, then she's just going to walk out of the house, but that doesn't happen.
Where did she get a bomb?
I don't know. I don't know where she got it from. I don't know where the know-how for this came in. Like, literally, she
stopped by the hardware store.
She hopped in a van and drove to this place is all she did, but... Yeah, so, like, I mean, the thing's going to explode in 5 minutes, so that should be it. But Crawford attacks her and chains her up in the sex dungeon and is about to bite her eyeball out, too. Which reminds me, it was very recently that we saw a movie where somebody who was possessed or whatever jumped up on someone and bit their eyeball out. And I said to you, God, I've never seen a horror movie where this has happened before. And now twice within the same month.
It was Evil Dead Rise.
Evil Dead Rise, that was it. Now I've seen it twice in a month.
Ed is the monster guy, eats Crawford's head, and then there are more ghost eels, but then the ghost eels
free her.
She tricks them into like biting her binds or whatever.
They free Catherine, and then she uses a matchbook to distract them because apparently they're all attracted by light, not just those bugs.
Yeah, well, and... the Ed monster has eaten Crawford's head, but then the next time the Ed monster confronts her, Crawford like tries to crawl out of its head.
Oh God, that was so funny. Actually, I think it was intentionally funny. He crawls out of the head, which is gross and reminded me a lot of Society, actually.
Yeah.
But then he kind of gets pulled back in, and then it's sort of like Pretorius crawls back out of him, and then he crawls out of him again. It's like,
and
they're
just
fighting each other
on the floor.
It's like this crazy Mobius strip of the two of them like coming out of each other and fighting each other. I kind of like that, actually. I thought that was fun.
I did too. It was super gross.
It was disgusting.
And practical and slimy and disgusting, and I liked it too. And then she makes it out, and oh no, she jumps out of the third story window right like as the bomb goes off, like it goes off right behind her.
Yeah,
she's fine.
Well, she does like break both of her legs. Like it was.
Oh, does she?
Oh yeah. I mean, the grossness doesn't end there. The minute we see her next, like she's got two bones sticking out of her knees. I was like, oh my God, this movie.
Too.
They don't care. They're just going to throw all that at us. Because the neighbor lady, the dog lady, comes back. Suddenly this house, which sort of seems like it's out in the middle of nowhere, but it has been established that there is at least one neighbor. Like suddenly like 15 people show up. They should have showed up a lot earlier as far as I'm concerned, but whatever. And this neighbor lady's like wanders over and she's like, are you okay? And she sees her legs. She's like, oh my God.
I missed that too. I must not have been paying very close attention. But then she just says, it ate him. And then she just starts laughing maniacally.
Yeah, I dug that.
And that's the end.
I like that. Like, it's driven her crazy, which is kind of a Lovecraft
sure.
thing, right? Like, everyone yeah. in their encounters with these monsters just drive them insane.
Yeah.
It's not my most favorite of the films we've seen, but it's definitely going to be in the top 20 of films I'll probably see again, just because the sheer insanity of it, the joy of the effects. Maybe mostly Barbara Crampton. I may hit the rewind button. I may ride that, you know, a little bit. But it just had everything as far as I'm concerned. A fine little mad scientist plot I could get behind. Some supernatural gobbledygook that I could buy. A bunch of disgusting, crazy effects. This monster, this thing-like thing that just every time it came out, just got more and more gross and disgusting. And I just loved the gusto with which it dove into that. Except for that bit in the hospital where it was just kind of boring watching Jeffrey Combs wander around and eat out, you know, five people's brains. I'll fast forward through that and watch the rest of the movie. I loved it. And I thought Barbara Crampton did a fantastic job. I thought he did a great job with the character he was given. I've got pretty much nothing bad to say about it. I wish I had seen it a lot earlier, honestly.
I can't believe it. I kept thinking as I was watching the first half hour, I have to have seen this before. I have to have. But I know for a fact that I haven't. And it was cemented when Barbara Crampton put on that dominatrix outfit. I'm like, no, I have not.
I would have remembered this.
Right, exactly. Right. And I can't believe it because that the image from the cover art, which is of the Edward in one of his later, yeah, with his face like stretched and gross. That's so at the forefront of my mind. Like that's
right.
Such an image that I remember.
Yeah.
And I can't believe that I haven't seen it, but I'm glad to have now. It was fun. It's silly.
Oh, it's goofy.
That's what it's going for. I mean, you can't cast Jeffrey Combs. I don't think you can. I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe he can do things differently, and this is just the way he does things because that's his thing. And I think it's great. I love it. I think that he's super fun. He's, like I said, like he's so expressive in his face. I'm a little bit envious. I mean, that's talent.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the movie overall. I agree with you 100%. Even at an hour 25, it was a little long, but only because of those hospital scenes. And it's not like I was like, oh, I want to stab my eyes out. No, I mean, they were fine. Just get back to the house and let's wrap this up.
Right.
Overall, I really enjoyed it. And I think that our, you know, the listeners that communicate with us seem to have similar tastes to us. And I think that they will really enjoy too. So if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's streaming all over the place for free.
Yeah, check this sucker out. Watch the unrated. I don't even know. Did I see the unrated edition? I'm not even sure.
I'm not either.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode and for joining us here. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend. You can find us all over online just by Googling Two Guys and a Chainsaw Podcast. Find our website, leave us a message, let us know what you thought of this film and what films you'd like us to do in the future. If you would like to support us, go to our Patreon. You can find that from our website as well. And for just $5 a month, you can get access to all kinds of great stuff. We have a little Christopher Pike book club going on.
So much fun.
It's actually been a blast, and I'm about to post a sample of that, actually. It'll probably already be out there by the time you hear this podcast. A lot of fun there. We have a lot of fun with our patrons. We post mini-sodes for them as well and uncut versions of our phone calls that we do here. Just go on over there and check it out. And if you'd like to support us, it's just $5 a month. Until next time, I'm Todd.
And I'm Craig.
With Two Guys and a Chainsaw.